know that assessment and feedback practices are among the most powerful levers educators have for improving student learning. Amidst the current uncertainty within HE, through a variety of different disruptors, and with the shifting pedagogic landscape in global higher education right now, there is a need to think seriously about how we put the significant resources devoted to assessment to better use to support students' learning, as well as academic staff development, and to improve assessment fitness for purpose more generally. My name is Stuart Norton, Senior Advisor in Learning and Teacher at Advance HE, and I'm leading the update to the Advance HE Student Success Framework series. I'm delighted to introduce these podcasts that are part of a range of activity linked to the forthcoming Advance HE Literature Review, authored by Dr. Ed Pitt and Professor Kathleen Quinlan, both from the University of Kent. Within their review, the authors advocate broad conceptions of assessment and feedback, centre student and learning, and prompt a rethink of traditional views on assessment and feedback. The review, this podcast, forthcoming webinars, and all associated activity provides a wealth of resources to help institutions and practitioners at all levels recognise the need for and the means to bring about evidence-informed transformational change. The review itself complements the wealth of research available, and their recommendations have been synthesised and drawn from a range of demonstrable outputs, and are designed to help higher education institutions, policymakers, and researchers alike to identify aspects you may wish to prioritise, consider, or review in relation to current policy and practice and assessment feedback, a review to rethinking and repositioning your assessment strategy, processes and practices. That being said, I'm using to hand over to the authors, who will now introduce themselves for this Advance HE Connect Benefit Series podcast.
Hello, my name is Kathleen Quinlan, and I'm a professor of higher education at the University of Kent's Centre for the Study of Higher Education. And I'm joined here today in this podcast by Dr. Ed Pitt, who is a senior lecturer in the Centre for the Study of Higher Education. We've worked together as co-authors on the literature review on assessment and feedback for Advance HE as part of its Student Success Connect Benefit Series. And we're going to talk about that review here today. So, hi, Ed. It's been a pleasure working with you on this assessment and feedback literature review and this pair of podcasts that we've been recording, one on assessment and this one on feedback, are a great opportunity to sit back and to just chat about what we learned from this review. Now, I know that you've been researching feedback in higher education for many years, and you're getting more and more requests from universities to speak about this subject. So you obviously knew this field well before embarking on this literature review. So I'm wondering if there were any surprises for you when systematically reviewing this literature on the subject over the past 5 years.
Yeah, thanks, Kathleen. I think probably what surprised me the most was the sheer range of research from across the globe and the sort of different places that people were publishing their work. You know, in this whole review, we've got 71 different countries represented, which is huge.
It is. It's really impressive.
Yeah, and I just hadn't realised that that might be the case, I think, and certainly in that short space of time. And one thing to say on that is that we do still have, you know, a real well-versed core group of researchers who publish in certain journals, and within these journals, when they're writing, they're often featuring the similar sort of authors. And indeed, I'm one of these. So it certainly opened my eyes to different areas within the field where some really great research is happening.
Right. So that sounds like there's really an opportunity for researchers in this field to make the field more inclusive by attending to a much wider range of literature than they might normally have attended to, and that may be published in a variety of different locations beyond just the kind of usual suspect journals.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, that's something I would definitely encourage. And I'm certainly going to encourage my collaborators to sort of start looking at these different pockets of research. So, as you say, we can become far more inclusive and sort of address this globalized understanding of assessment and feedback.
Are there any other surprises or areas that have begun to emerge?
Yeah, authors have started to look for more what I'd call impactful outcomes, such as improved learning behaviours, feedback literacy development, and performance grade improvements. And I think probably this work started to emerge as a result of the seminal 2018 Carlos and Baud feedback literacy paper. And lots and lots of authors have taken the ideas and conceptions within that paper and explored it from many different angles. And what we're starting to see is really good conceptual and theoretical interrogation of feedback literacy. And I expect that probably to increase in the coming years for sure.
That's interesting. You often, I know, speak about the need for a culture change around feedback, and that's the language we've used in the review and in the recommendations as well, particularly the fifth recommendation of the report. So I wonder if you can say more about what the current culture of feedback seems to be, and based on the review of evidence, what the new culture needs to be.
Yeah, I'm often heard saying this in discussion with colleagues and as you mentioned, some talks that I've been recently giving. And I think it kind of chimes a little bit with what you've been saying about the surprising parts of the review. I think there was an element of, you know, continuing to do things in the same way that we've already sort of done and gone over and over and over again in the literature in the early 2000s, for example, and conceiving feedback in those ways. We're probably going to see people feeling the same frustrations that things are not changing or getting better. So the way I explain it to people is that the importance of something called ongoing dialogue in the feedback process is essential to changing this feedback culture. And what I'm advocating here is us moving away from seeing feedback as a process that is done to students towards giving primacy to the role of the student in the process, whereby they're encouraged to seek and discuss information, you know, from multiple sources that enables them to develop their understanding of what constitutes quality and really empowers them to take action on feedback. And I think the action part is something that's central to this cultural change about seeing uptake of feedback.
Now, you mentioned ongoing dialogue, and that's a term I hear often in the feedback literature, dialogic feedback. And so I wonder if you can just clarify that. Do you mean dialogue in the sense of oral or verbal conversation, or do you mean it more in the sense that it's a two-way exchange between students and teachers?
Yeah, and I'm often reminded of what David Carlos has said about dialogic feedback, that it involves these sort of iterative processes in which interpretations are shared, meanings negotiated, perhaps expectations clarified in order to promote this student uptake of feedback. So dialogue in this sense is any sort of communication during the process between players, you know, so students and educators, peers. So it doesn't have to be a conversation per se to be dialogue. Mm-hmm. What we're talking here about is exchanges between these people that are involved in that feedback situation.
Okay, so it's this back and forth two-way exchange that's connecting to the point you were making about getting students much more actively involved in the process.
Yeah.
So how is this then a different culture of feedback?
Yeah, and I think it is fundamentally about uptake of feedback. And this is certainly something I've been concentrated on in the last few years. And I think where this needs to change is that students need opportunities for their feedback to land somewhere. So when we talk about the changes in culture, people often talk about the older paradigm of giving feedback to students at the end of, say, a summative episode of work. And that's really been questioned in recent years. And we saw many examples in the review where dialogue followed grading and this was promoted. So this was sort of the older paradigm way of thinking. Mm. But I think more needs to be done to incorporate these opportunities throughout students' course experience. So things like during production of drafts or, you know, at the point perhaps of submission where there's a sort of an interactive cover sheet where students are directly requesting the sort of feedback they want so that these dialogues are happening, as well as obviously sometimes after the summative marking. So it is more about the timing of when feedback happens, and it's more use during the process than at the end for a student. So where I see the culture needing to shift towards is in these formative opportunities that can be created by the educator. So what I'm talking about is the bit that happens when students are completing their work. And for this to change, then the culture students need to understand is their view of feedback, so that it's sort of not just something that happens at the end or is associated with summative work. So we want in students to think about feedback existing within their entire experience and not just something that's bolted on at the end of a piece of work.
And did you find some good examples of that in the review?
Yeah, there are quite a few, actually. And one that springs to mind is Rochelle Esterházy and Karina Damza over in Norway. They've done some great work looking at different courses. And one that is in my mind at the moment is this 20-week undergraduate biology course that they looked at, where students had to complete 3 group assignments and participate in what they called several iterative written feedback episodes with their peers and the educator. So the sort of interactions that students were having with each other, the educator, and all of the resources that were available within the curricula, these mediated how the students advanced their understanding of the discipline. So essentially through the curriculum and those exchanges, they had opportunities to enact feedback, self-evaluate, and improve their future work. And the educators had created a culture of students finding solutions for themselves rather than telling them the answers. And I think what this did was prompt students' responsibility for the meaning making and the acting on feedback. And I think this is the sort of practice that really encapsulates this uptake element that I was talking about earlier.
So it was iterative. Was this a case of working on the same product, maybe a big assignment, throughout a term so that they could draft and redraft the same piece of work?
Yeah, exactly that. Yes. So it was the same assignment that they honed over and over again with their peer. So they had 3 assignments to complete. For each one, the students met 5 times per assignment over an 18-week period. So they would work together on the draft, they would refine the draft, and then after 2 of these meetings, the educator would see the draft, they would provide some feedback, the students would then come back together, would work on that draft to complete draft 2. Wow. And then after that process would have some period of reflection and then go back to it, refine the draft again, and then finally submit the essay. So there was lots of back and forth and lots of individual inputs from peers and also taken into consideration. But as you see, the way I've described there, it wasn't completely educator-driven feedback. You know, there was lots of peer interaction. And I think the group work was what sort of made this distinction, really.
Right. So we see that culture shift. We've got the dialogue happening. We've got the interaction repeatedly between the student and peers and repeatedly between the student and the teacher. And we're seeing these opportunities for students to take up that feedback through the next version of the same assignment.
Absolutely.
That's really pretty rare in the sector, isn't it? I often hear academics talking about how much time pressure they feel and that kind of prompts them to run from one assignment to another one without giving opportunities for that drafting and redrafting.
Absolutely, you know, and I completely understand that. But I think the neat thing that is in this example is that students were working in groups and learning from each other too, which I think is significant. And they weren't solely reliant upon the educator-derived feedback. You know, in that example, there was only one instance of draft. And yet there was 4 instances of peer feedback interaction. So I think, you know, the peer element within this and the way that students were able to give feedback to each other was incredibly powerful to help these students rather than just be solely reliant upon the educator generated feedback.
And we have a whole section on peer feedback in the review. And it seems that peer feedback is a very effective practice for learning about what standards of work are expected.
Absolutely. And spoiler alert for those of you that haven't read the review. Yes, there's a huge effect size, huge benefit. And that's not to say that there isn't some educator involvement. Clearly there is. There's lots of elements in scaffolding. We talk about anonymity and all those sorts of things. It's a really comprehensive section that draws upon several systematic reviews from some excellent researchers in the field. And I think what we've tried to do in that section is to really flesh out how small tweaks to practice can achieve some of those positives. And I also think it's educators designing this into their curricula. So, you know, in my own research recently with David Carlos, we've shone a lens on practices that harness the power of these interactions within the classroom. So we explored performance arts, which is different to the example I gave on biology, where they used exemplars and related discussion about the quality to help students improve their own performances. And similarly, they generated opportunities to act upon peer feedback through those learning activities. So students were also encouraged to generate self-feedback, which is an area that started to come out in the literature through work with David Nicol. So they're calibrating the quality of their own performance to that of their peers. And in all of these examples, they had the opportunity to refine and improve their outputs prior to summative submission. So in a sense, that feedback had somewhere to land before they needed to submit.
Great. Now, you've used the word exemplar here, and I think that that might be something that's a bit confusing to folks who are not as familiar with this field. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, so these might be pre-chosen examples of work. They might be, say, a full essay, or they might be a small section of an essay. Quite often, people will use a range of examples, perhaps through the grade boundaries, and students will work with these examples and they will spend time perhaps marking them using the criteria that the educator would have used and start to make judgments about the different levels of quality that exist within the examples. And quite often this is a very iterative process, a very dialogic process. Sometimes at the end of that process, the educator will say, well, this is how I would have marked this, or, you know, students will come up with their own criteria. There are lots of different ways of using exemplars, but I think the underpinning of it is being able to show and demonstrate to students what good work looks like and equally what bad work works like. And I think one of the really important things within this is that students need to be able to then reference that to their own work. And that's the real tipping point in the success of exemplars, is them being able to take all that learning from that process and then going look at their own work to see where they realistically sit against those comparisons of quality.
So that term exemplar is a slight misnomer, isn't it? Because you're actually engaging students in working with a range of examples of varying quality so they can appreciate higher quality from lower quality and what distinguishes these. But I think that's a really important point that you make too, that just because they can do that with a peer's work, can they then translate that into improvements in their own work?
Absolutely.
And maybe that connects with this idea of uptake that you were speaking about earlier.
Yeah, absolutely. I really think that that's the key thing here. Examples is a good word to use, I think, you're right. And it's not necessarily a formulaic perfect answer, and this is what you should do, because obviously lots of different subjects have different ways of attacking the same issue, the same problem. So it's more about the engagement and recognizing the quality and being able to make judgments that really is at the heart of exemplars.
Great. So I wonder if you can say more about uptake, because that's obviously so critical to this culture shift.
Yeah, and we saw lots of examples, and I am reminded of the second year ecology students example from Hill and West, where they got students to discuss an assessment, which was an essay, during class time, and asked the students to write a draft and then discuss it individually face to face with their educator to generate feedback. Now, that might sound like something that everyone's doing that does drafts, but what they also did was get the students to attend a seminar where they participated in a group marking exercise with, in this case, two exemplar essays from previous cohorts and compared their marking with that of the educator. They then marked their own draft essay, reflected on the educator feedback and the feedback generated in the group marking exercise. So this is this bit where I say referencing it to their own work, because they've already produced a draft. Mm. And what this was designed to do was to help them judge the quality of their own work in reference to others and the criteria. And those students that participated in that received a mean mark of 63%, which was 7% higher than the cohort in previous years who were not exposed to that experience. So the other great bit about this having an effect upon students is that when they ask these students in their final year, you know, do you remember that process? What happened about as a result of it? They all reported that they'd continued those feedback behaviors and engaged in those learning behaviors in their final year of study. So there was some enduring quality to experiencing that for those students. So it had an impact over the longer term, which again, I think is something that's really important for us to consider.
Wow, that's really an impactful intervention then.
Yeah, I think so. And it is about designing these formative tasks and the feedback opportunities to incrementally help students develop prior to submitting their final summative pieces. So we need them to understand the potential, the impact that feedback can have on their learning over this longer term. So what we're trying to avoid is these isolated small interventions that just happen as a one-off, maybe in a module on their own. And, you know, they sometimes they might not even produce increased satisfaction or learning outcomes. So we're trying to avoid that, I think.
So that's another really important point that hasn't been highlighted yet in the conversation, which is this need to shift from just thinking about the module, my module, what I teach on my module, to thinking much more in program terms. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, having this more joined up approach is something that I certainly would advocate, you know, and educators talking to each other, thinking about how the wider student experience is constructed.
So when I raise these kinds of ideas with academics, and of course, you and I both are working with academics in the teaching that we do, we're teaching new academics about learning and teaching and assessment and feedback. And so when I raise these ideas, our colleagues often, again, I mentioned this earlier, but they often say that they don't have time. And, you know, there just seems to be such a cult of content coverage. They feel they don't have time to focus on these kinds of activities like peer discussions of exemplars and peer feedback activities. And I have my way of responding to that, but I'm curious how you respond to those kinds of objections.
Yeah, and this is an all too familiar response, and I get it. You know, people are incredibly busy. There's lots of pressures. You know, people are spinning lots and lots of different plates at the same time. But I think if we keep doing things in the same way and expect a different outcome, then it's ultimately going to end up in disappointment.
I've heard that described as the definition of insanity, doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different outcome. So, all right, we need to stop being insane.
Indeed, yeah. And indeed, you know, in this, you know, I've mentioned the early 2000s research, you know, there is an element of frustration and disappointment that the efforts that one goes to in this area are not often recognized, and you end up getting the same results for satisfaction, for example. So I say to people, try and think about this in a different way. Are there activities that privilege more active roles for students where they can work with subject content and benefit from things like exposure to exemplars or making judgments related to quality? And I find these design tweaks can often lead to students developing greater knowledge of the subject content as they're directly working with it and applying it to real activities rather than, say, you know, viewing 12 weeks of content. So I think the pandemic has perhaps opened our eyes to how students can experience content.
What do you mean then by that?
So in the last few years, many of us have recorded lectures, asked students to watch in advance of the contact time so that maybe that time can then be reapportioned to discussion. So maybe it's time to view how we teach modules or courses in perhaps a slightly different way. The contact time that we have with students is probably, what, 10 to 15% of the total learning hours for a course. So could the delivery be seen as more independent? And then students are coming to the contact hours and they're sort of going through some of these things that we've been highlighting in the podcast and the wider review and do that in that time.
Interesting. So you're basically advocating the same kind of logic as a flipped classroom, where you're causing people to rethink what they do with that precious contact time and use that contact time for more activity and use the other outside of contact time for students to listen to lectures, listen to podcasts, read around the subject.
Yeah, I suppose it is. You know, and I think the world's changed in that way and how we engage with content has changed. And what I'm trying to say is that can we create more active spaces in our teaching time to work on things like feedback literacy development? And it doesn't have to be the educator doing everything. You know, they're the designer, they build the scaffold, they put that up. But it's the students that have got to build that metaphorical learning house. They've got to bring all those bits together because the educator can't do everything because that's not realistic.
Yeah. I take a slightly different tack when I explain it to academics, which it will perhaps not surprise you, especially based on what we've talked about around assessment. But I often emphasize the point that, again, which ties to the assessment part of our review too, that if our assessments are authentic, if they really reflect the real world demands of the profession or the discipline or the world that students are going to affect, then spending time on honing students' abilities to respond to those assessments is at the heart of the educational process. and I could put it in a different way, and I sometimes do. We want to teach to those kinds of tests. So often we hear, well, we don't want to teach to a test. But if you design the assessments in such a way that they are richly tapping the key skills that are needed for the discipline or the profession, then we precisely do want to teach to those kinds of tests. And if we do that, it also seems to me that these kinds of assessments are designed in ways that then emphasize skills, which helps to move us away from that one-off approach to feedback that you were talking about earlier, either the one-off by to students or teachers, and feedback that then pertains only to that particular assessment. So I guess, in effect, what I'm saying is we need to focus on helping students practicing key skills, not just demonstrating that they understand a specific concept or information or even theory. And that when we do that, then spending time on clarifying assessment criteria through the kinds of activities you've been talking about here is very well spent time, because it's teaching students exactly what is important to the field, exactly what they should be learning and getting successfully better at through a series of assessments across the degree.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And, you know, when I think about specifically around feedback, I'm always reminded of a student I interviewed during my PhD who was at the end of their final year. And they said to me, oh, you know, the problem with feedback from this module is that I'm not allowed to use it in another one, am I? And that stuck with me to this day. As I felt we failed to get to the heart of what you've just explained with that student, you know, seeing feedback as compartmentalized episodes that are tied to a particular task or activity or module is really problematic. So I think we've got to think more carefully about design of assessment and feedback together at the point when we perhaps design our curricula.
Yeah, and I think that the design of assessment and feedback together is a key point in there. And that's really where the two parts of our review come together. We need to be thinking about assessment and feedback design together.
There hasn't been enough attention paid to these intersections between assessment and feedback design. And I think that's probably somewhere that we should look to develop in the field, really.
Right. So that's a problem. Do you have any ideas about how we can promote that?
Yeah, I have been giving this some thought recently because, you know, we're coming out of the pandemic and I'm expecting things to happen locally, but I suspect it's going to be the same across the sector. And maybe at the time when programs are being revalidated, could be a good opportunity to see that assessment and feedback experience holistically. So it's a moment when educators can focus on understanding how their bits fit into the wider goal of the program and joining up what different colleagues are doing. And I think by looking at it in this way, it will help educators to see where and how opportunities could be created in the curricula, but also, again, to help guide the students through the forest of feedback opportunity.
Forest of feedback opportunity. I like that. You know I'm a poet. But I love that. Forest of feedback opportunity. What do we mean by forest here?
Well, I think it's all of what I've said is about educators creating those opportunities, because those opportunities are crucial to learning. And, you know, we do that always as we're designing curricula, I'm sure, and to varying degrees. But students don't always see those opportunities or value how they contribute to their learning. So I think we have to help them see and, you know, as I say, take them by the hand and walk them through those opportunities so that, you know, we get the credit for what we're trying to do. But also, you know, from a motivational point of view, and I know you've got lots of research and interest, the interest point of view, you know, I'm doing this because this is the benefit it's going to have on my learning. I think that's where we need to change the narrative around feedback. You know, seeing that as a crucial part, and as I mentioned earlier, not just something that happens at the end, because really good feedback can have a really positive effect on students' learning.
What you're saying, I think, is that students need to be taught about those opportunities and how to make best use of those opportunities. And we saw something similar, of course, with the assessment side of the review, insofar as students need to be taught how to approach an assessment, and especially new assessments. And so this seems to be something that's a common theme here.
And it's a major part of feedback literacy that I mentioned earlier. So it's seeing assessment and feedback as integral to driving learning along the way rather than something that happens at the end. So it's seeing that there are opportunities all around them. So the educator shouldn't always be responsible for generating the feedback. Their students should be actively seeking it, generating it for peers and themselves. For me, this is what replicates perhaps what's happening in the world of work. Well, I mean, indeed, it's probably the expectation of industry. So if we're true to our mission of employable graduates, which we all ascribe to, then this should be the cultural shift that we move to in higher education.
I think that's a really interesting point. If we're helping students to perceive the feedback opportunities that are embedded in their everyday classroom activities, that's a preparation for the way in which feedback is also integrated into everyday workplace interactions, and that allows them to continue that process of learning through those embedded feedback opportunities. That's a really nice connection to employability.
Yeah, I think so.
So, is there anything, we've been talking about all these different elements, really, of this shift in feedback culture. And I wonder if you could share some of your thoughts about what policymakers can do to support this kind of culture shift.
I think one of the issues that we have, certainly in the UK, but I'm aware of other satisfaction metrics that exist across the world, is the sort of questions that are asked about assessment and feedback. Because I think they've got a big role to play in how universities plan to address them and how more broadly the sector views, for example, assessment and feedback. So most universities have a sort of turnaround period for getting marks feedback to students, because in one of the questions, the word timely is used. And that's the kind of way that it's been interpreted. So, you know, they'll say to students, your feedback and marks will come back to you within 3 weeks, in the hope that students will view that as timely. Mm-hmm. The problem is students interpret feedback as only being tied to this turnaround on their summative work, and is in direct conflict to the kinds of practice that I've been talking about in this podcast. I guess another question that springs to mind is the one that says, I received helpful comments on my work. Mm-hmm. And the word received implies passiveness on the part of the student. And again, that's problematic if we're trying to change the culture where students are active, they're seeking it, you know, they're trying to engage with feedback in different ways than it just being, I guess people would call it the feedback cannon, where it's feedback is just shot at them.
Yes, or dumped on them, like truck.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Unloading its contents. Yes.
Yeah.
So how would you change the wording then?
Well, I mean, myself and colleague Naomi Winston have been talking about this for the last 5 years. Indeed, we did an article in the Times Higher a good few years ago.
I remember that.
Yeah. And in that article, I think it's worth bringing up again, is that, you know, the question such as I was supported to seek and utilize feedback that I needed to help me in my learning might be better, so that students recognize, engage with and enact feedback, and perhaps improvements on these metrics might happen as a byproduct. But at least a more learning focused practice will be promoted if we move to this way of doing things.
Yeah, I think that's a great aspiration to reconsider the National Student Survey in the UK. It also strikes me as somewhat unlikely, no matter how wonderful this review has been and these podcasts have been, that this is likely to occur immediately. So I'm wondering if, short of that, might universities change their own module student evaluation forms in a similar way as what you're proposing to reflect the kind of principles you've been describing?
Yeah, so for policies and the like, it could be a way of suggesting that we view these a little bit differently and focus upon learning improvement and less about metric performance. And that could be one way to drive change. So module evaluations could focus upon the opportunities that educators have created in the curriculum to help students understand feedback.
That forest of opportunity.
That forest of opportunity, mm-hmm. where it can be used and how uptake has been fostered. Now, this might subtly then indicate how the university wishes feedback to be conceived of, and over time change the culture of understanding it, so that we avoid this insanity that we mentioned earlier in the podcast.
Right. So, of course, it's not all about carrots and sticks. And obviously, evaluations like this are kind of carrot and sticks. But it's really about educating academics through various channels, isn't it?
Yeah, I think you're right. And maybe seeing it as leveraging these sometimes rigid policies locally and trying to influence a culture that I've discussed. I guess what I'm trying to also advocate is that some of these things might reduce workload, you know, and I know that's a real pressure in the longer term, as students might not be so reliant upon the educator generated feedback. You know, you could see it as a decreasing term, much like the payments on your mortgage. If you sort of overpay at the start of the first year and the second year, you know, we really scaffold the feedback. There's lots of feedback. It's rich. And by the end of the third year, they're less reliant because they're generating feedback themselves as we ease that transition to them going into the world of work, where someone isn't always going to be there on hand to tell you the answers.
That's great. That's a really, really nice point to end on. So thank you, Ed, for that. And I really enjoyed recording this podcast with you and the other one on assessment. And listeners can also check out the full review in the assessment and feedback section of the Student Success Connect Benefit series on the Advance HE website.